will be going over the song When I Survey the Wondrous Cross this morning. And so I will read you a little bit of the backstory here, and then we'll dig into some theology on this song. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross is the song this morning. And so a little bit of story. It was written in 1707 by Isaac Watts. And this says, after Isaac Watts finished his college studies and returned home to Southampton, he wrote many of his now immortalized hymns for Above Bar Congregational Church. In 1696, Isaac, at age 22, left home for London to become a tutor. All the while, he was feeling a clear tug toward ministry. On his 24th birthday, July 17, 1698, Isaac preached his first sermon. The following year, he became assistant pastor of London's Mark Zane Church. In March of 1700, Isaac received a long letter from his brother, Enoch, urging him to publish the hymns he had written in Southampton. The letter said this, "Dear brother, in your last letter, you mentioned an inclination to oblige the world by showing it your hymn in print, and I heartily wish that you were something more than inclined thereunto. I am very confident whoever has the happiness of reading your hymns, unless he be either sot or atheist, will have a very favorable opinion of their author. There is a great need of a pen, vigorous and lively as yours, to quicken and revive the dying devotion of the age. Yours now is the old truth, stripped of its ragged ornaments, and appears, if we may say so, younger, by ages in a new and fashionable dress." So that was the letter from his brother, basically urging him to go ahead and write hymns because he's such a great writer, even at a young age. And then it continues, Isaac, however, hesitated. He had other obligations on his time. On March 8th, 1702, he became Mark Lane's pastor, Mark Lane being a church there. The next year, 1703, the church chose Samuel Price of Wales to assist Isaac. Due to the latter's fragile health, under the preaching of these two, the old dying church revived. The building grew too small for the crowds, and a new house of worship was built down the street. Finally, in 1707, Watts published his hymns, selling the copyright to a Mr. Lawrence, the publisher, for £10. This volume was an instant success. It was enlarged and republished in 1709. So this song, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, appeared in his 1707 book of hymns, inspired by Galatians 6:14. It was originally titled Crucifixion to the World by the Cross of Christ. Many consider it the finest hymn in English church history, and Charles Wesley reportedly said he would rather have written it than all of his own. And as you know, Charles Wesley was also a very prolific writer. And so he himself said, this song is the best song ever written. He wished he would have written it. And I believe Charles Wesley, this could be wrong, I'm trying to remember from past things, I believe he wrote 800 different hymns, or maybe between him and his brother, they wrote 800. And Charles wrote the vast majority over John. And so he wrote a lot of very good hymns. And so today we'll look at When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. And to survey something means to appraise it. So when we say, when I survey the wondrous cross, we're saying, I want to appraise the wondrous cross. I want to assess the value of this cross. That's what appraise means. It means to assess the value of something. And so when you buy a house, there are two assessments or appraisals that you need to make. Number one, what the house is worth, and number two, what can you afford? And I wouldn't solely rely on the bank to help you with this. They will help you get a pretty accurate value of the home after, which we'll talk about that in a second, from an appraisal. They will also tell you what you can probably afford, but they will generally loan you far more than what you can afford. But these are the two appraisals or assessments that you should make when you purchase a home. And I've always thought the house buying process is a little backwards, because this is how it generally works for us. We kind of think through, hopefully deeply think through what we can afford, and then we go find a house that we like, and we make a value or assessment on what we think it's worth or what we want to pay. Then we make an offer, All of this before we know the actual value of the home. And I mean that from the formal appraisal. We can know the value of the home by what realtor.com says, which doesn't mean that's the true value of the home. We can know the value of the home from what the buyer wants or from what the realtor says. And all of these things are a little bit variable because it's not necessarily the value of the home. Now, I get the real estate market kind of ebb and flows with demand and supply. And if a lot of people want houses, those prices are going up. And if no one wants houses, you're not going to be able to sell it for top dollar. But this seems a little backwards to me because we see what we can afford, we make an offer, and then we find out what the house is worth in light of the appraiser, which the bank solely goes off of that number. And again, that this has always seemed a little backwards. It would seem right if we knew what the house is worth, right? What the appraiser says it's worth and what the bank is going to go off of on loaning you the money if you're taking out a loan. The problem with this is if you way over buy a house because you want it, and you say you pay $150,000 for a house, but it appraises for $120,000. If the bank's giving you an 80-20 deal, they're only going to loan you 80% of the $120,000. So you're not getting a full 80% because you way overpaid, right? So all that to say, this seems a little backwards to me. And this is not the way we need to appraise the cross. But there are two things we need to appraise with the cross, just like two things we need to appraise or assess the value of with a home. This song captures two things for us: the essence of Christ's sacrifice on the cross and the appropriate Christian response to that sacrifice. So again, what the value of the cross is and what the assessment or value is of that to us as far as our current possessions and what we want to give up. Most people don't assess the value of the cross at all, right? 1 Corinthians 1:18 says the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. Those who are perishing, those who do not love Christ, they don't assess the value of the cross. They, in fact, think it's of zero value or negative value. It's foolishness to them. They don't care about it. They don't understand it. They see no reason why the God-man would come to earth in humility as he did. So it's foolishness to them. They don't assess this value. It's sad to say, I would imagine there might be some in here this morning, and I mean here later when we sing this song, that don't assess the value of the cross, yet they'll be singing this. They'll be singing "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." But this is something that we need to assess. This is something the song demands us to assess. If you get a second, Peter, you might throw that up there. And so we'll look at those four verses here in a bit. And so we want to rightly and accurately assess the value of the cross. We can only do this if we're Christians, if we do love Christ. And so again, there's two things we want to keep in mind: to assess the assessment of Christ's sacrifice on the cross and the appropriate Christian response to that sacrifice. Just as when we assess the value of a home rightly, we then know accurately what to offer on the home. So also, when we appraise the value of the cross rightly, it will help us accurately understand what our response must be. And I do say that carefully, what our response must be, not what we are going to offer, because we offer nothing. We offer our lives in one sense, but we have nothing to offer as far as value. And so that's, please don't take the analogy of we're going to assess the cross and figure out what we're going to give back. That's not how this works. But in the assessment of the cross, we do need to understand the appropriate response that we must have as Christians. And so we'll read through verse 1 here. It says, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride." And so turn to Philippians chapter 3 with me. Philippians chapter 3, we'll look at verse 4 through 8. Proverbs speaks of there being safety in a multitude of counselors. And so we want to see what other men of the faith have assessed as far as the cross is concerned, what they came up with when they looked at the cross, and what they in turn did with their life. And so we'll first look at the Apostle Paul, and then we'll look at Moses here in a bit. But let's see what Paul comes up with when he appraises the cross. Philippians 3, verses 4 through 8. Paul says this, "Though I myself have reason for confidence in the flesh also, if anyone else thinks he has reason for confidence in the flesh, I have more." And then right here in verse 5, he's about to give us the appraisal of his past life, things he has, things he's accomplished. And here's his assessment of his life. Verse 5, "I was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee," which is not a bad thing, it's a good thing in this context. "As to zeal, a persecutor of the church," also a good thing, I'll explain in a second. "As to righteousness under the law, blameless." So Paul has much going for him here. Many things here, most things here, we have none of, right? He's a Hebrew of Hebrews, circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, even better, a Hebrew of Hebrews, even better, scholarly meaning. "As to the law, a Pharisee," meaning he kept it to a T, outwardly. And then this, "as to zeal, a persecutor of the church," at face value, we think that's like a bad thing thrown in a list of really good things. In this context, and in his mind at the time, it's a wonderful thing. Because remember, he's coming from a very Jewish background, thinking he loves the law, loves God's law from the Old Testament, and thinking the church is messing that up completely. That the church is speaking total heresy. And so he's coming up against the church. He's persecuting the church, the thing he thinks that is evil, to keep God's law holy. So he thought this was a great thing. And so that's Paul's assessment of all of his belongings, all of his gifts and the things he was born into, which again is great on a human level. But now look at verse 7 with me. Now he turns to assessing the cross. Verse 7, "But whatever gain I had, I count it as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ." Notice here in verse 8, Paul counts everything as loss because of the what? There at the beginning of verse 8, why does he count all things as loss? What's that? Sorry. Because of the worth of knowing Christ. Which, think of that just for a second. He doesn't count all of his things as loss because of things he's gained from Christ or things Christ has done. He counts all of his grand things that he has as loss just for knowing Christ, just simply knowing him. And then he continues, then Paul counts them as rubbish. Look at the end of verse 8. He says, "For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish," all these things I just mentioned above, "in order that I may gain Christ." This is Paul's assessment of the cross and then what it did to him or what it made him do as far as a response with his life. He counted all the things that he had that were grand above most people in that day and age, counted them as loss, as foolishness, as something that were worthless in light of even just simply knowing Christ. Paul understood that losing things that aren't precious to you doesn't hurt. And we'll talk about this hopefully much today. This understanding of it's not just duty to serve Christ, it's delight. A true Christian will be delighted in loving Christ and serving him, not waking up every day just thinking it's a duty that must be done, right? If it's just a duty, that's Pharisaical. That's hypocritical. But Paul understood this after he was saved, that losing these things that aren't precious to you doesn't hurt. So if it's hard to sacrifice all the things of this life, that probably means that they're very precious to you. When it's easy to sacrifice those things and to turn to Christ, that means your love is in the right spot. Your love is towards Christ. Think of the Royal Gorge in Colorado. So it's this, if you haven't been there, it's this very deep but kind of narrow ravine. It's beautiful. It's large and very, very deep. Not like the Grand Canyon, but it's more narrow. There's a bridge going across this Royal Gorge. There might be a couple. But if you've been there, the one bridge, it kind of has some like wood planks and you can walk across it. Imagine if you're walking across this bridge and say you trip on one of the wood planks and you kind of stumble and a dime rolls out of your pocket, or even a quarter. Rolls out of your pocket, falls between the cracks, and falls for seconds and seconds all the way down to the very bottom of that. So most of us would probably not spend the time to go find that dime or that quarter, because it's going to take a long time to get to the bottom of that Royal Gorge. You're probably on vacation, and it's going to take a good chunk of the day, and it's going to be difficult. That dime is probably not worth the value of the time it's going to take to go down and get that, right? I would imagine. Now let's crank it up a little bit. What if you had five $100 bills in your pocket, and you stumbled, and somehow those shimmied out of your pocket and kind of blew off the bridge, and you saw them float down, probably take a couple minutes, you saw them hit the ground. Five $100 bills, so $500. Would you go pick those up? Which we've got one more example coming, by the way. But remember, this is going to take you a long time on vacation, probably ruin whatever other plans you have to go get those at the bottom of the Royal Gorge. I would imagine some in here would be like, oh yeah, that's $500. Others in here might be like, that's a lot of money, but I don't know if I want to go get that. Because we're assessing the value of what we're losing. And then next, think it could be a large amount of money, or think you have a briefcase that's an heirloom full of diamonds that you're going to take to a jeweler in Colorado, which is a very kind of popular thing in Colorado, stones or jewels. You're going to take it to one of those stores and get paid for that briefcase of diamonds. Let's say it's millions of dollars. Well, if you stumble because you're walking across the bridge and you drop that, I would imagine most of us would go spend the rest of the day, cancel all other plans, and go get that briefcase. Why? Because it's very valuable to us, because it's a lot of money. We've made the assessment that it is worth going and getting. Well, again, this is what we're doing with the cross. We're assessing the value of the cross compared to the value of things that we want or that we have, whether it be physical possessions or giftedness, things in life. Even as the Apostle Paul, his background, his very name, his reputation, the tribes he came from, things that are very important on a human level. One line in this song, the second line here, on which the Prince of Glory died. Just a little side note, this doesn't appear in the Bible as a whole, but from Isaiah 9:6, which says the Prince of Peace, and Psalm 24:7, which calls Jesus the King of Glory, they kind of squished those together and said the Prince of Glory. So you have Prince of Peace, King of Glory, and that's where this line comes from. And so we'll go to verse 2. You can flip to verse 2. It says, "Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charmed me most, I sacrificed them to his blood." Now to turn to Galatians 6:14. Galatians 6:14, this verse is, as far as we can tell, exactly where this second verse was written. So I imagine Isaac Watts was looking at Galatians 6:14 when he wrote verse 2, because it's almost verbatim. Galatians 6:14. Hear how similar this is. It says, "But far be it from me to boast, except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world." And then in our verse 2 of this song, it says, "Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death," or "except for in the death of Christ my God." And so again, word for word, this Galatians 6:14 was even in the book we just read, saying that he wrote it directly out of there. But I want to look at the two last lines in Galatians 6:14 there. Look at verse 14. Paul says, "Except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world." And so what do you guys think this phrase, "the world has been crucified to me," Paul's saying? What do you guys think that means? Yeah, everything in the world or anything the world represents has been put to death in the view of Paul. He used to look at things in the world and think they're very valuable. And now when he looks at the world, They're rubbish to him, if you will. It no longer has any beauty. It's been put to death to him. 1 John 2:15 through 16 is helpful here. It says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world." That's hard to do if you love the world. In fact, I would say that's impossible to do if you love the world, because it says, do not love the world. But if your eyes are fixed on Christ, if he is your most prized possession, then following 1 John 2 will be far more easy to not love the world or the things of the world. And so that's what it means that the world has been crucified to me. And then Paul says at the end of verse 14, "And I to the world," or "I have been crucified to the world." What do you guys think that means, being crucified to the world? Yeah, they don't mesh together. So if the world has been dead to Paul, that means when Paul looks at the world, he doesn't care about it anymore. It's rubbish to him. And then if you flip that around as Paul did, and he's been crucified to the world, that means now when the world looks at Paul, Paul is rubbish to the world. So Paul used to be a very useful tool to the world. He thought he was being godly, but he was persecuting Christians. He was destroying the church. So the world, or think the devil, was using him. The world loved Paul, but now the world hates Paul. Paul's been crucified to the world. Paul is spoiled to the world. Think of rotten food. So if the world now looks at Paul, it's just a rotten piece of meat on the hot summer ground. They don't want anything to do with him. He's a disease. He no longer has or gives any interest to the world. Look at Hebrews chapter 11. We'll look at now Moses' assessment of the cross. We've looked at Paul's assessment. Obviously a very godly man. Now let's look at Moses' assessment of the cross. Hebrews 11, 24 through 26. Hebrews 11, 24 through 26. It says, "By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward." Moses didn't desire the fleeting pleasures of sin most and then try to seek after God. And I fear that oftentimes it's either presented this way to us or we think this is how it works, that life's tough and we're sinful, so we're always going to wrestle with this. We're always going to have a little bit of love for the world, but we know the right thing to do is obey Christ, and so we're going to be in this battle. And to one extent, that is true. This side of glory, we will always be sinners. We will always wrestle with our flesh. But there also needs to be truth for a genuine love for Christ above all things on this earth. This will define a true Christian. This was true of Moses, it was true of Paul, that he didn't desire these things of sin most, and then simply try to seek after God as if that was his duty. That was Moses' delight to seek after God. It was his delight to put aside all of these things that he could have been or could have done. In the kingdom there of Egypt, he could have had massive amounts of treasures. He could have been brought into that family even more than he was, taken on the name, been there in the palace to whatever position he would have been, and been quite rich in this life. But it wasn't that he put all that aside just because he knew the best thing to do was follow after God at the time. He wanted to put all those things aside because the worth of knowing God, even being persecuted with other believers at the time, it says, was of far more value than all the riches that he could have ever had. When you try to do this out of duty rather than delight, it will equal in 100%, or it'll equal in failure 100% of the time, guaranteed. It's like staring at a chocolate cake in the face while you're eating on cauliflower when you're really, really hungry. And you're just staring at that chocolate cake, trying to get this cauliflower down. It's like, it's going to take a massive amount of self-control and probably going to cave in. And even if we don't physically cave in, our delight is not in the cauliflower. Our delight is in the chocolate cake, right? This is also like thinking you can have one foot in the world and one foot in heaven, as some people say, right? I'm going to live in this world and enjoy the world, but I'm also going to try to live in the church and put my other foot in the church on Sundays. One author said this is simply having both feet in the world all the time. You're just deceived. You can't have one foot in two different places. This won't work. If sin tastes sweet to you while righteousness is hard to swallow, you're not going to pursue righteousness, which means you're not going to pursue God. Again, if this is out of duty, this won't have any longevity to it. Just think of, well, I don't know if all of you were here, but if you were here for the conference that Mike Riccardi came and did on sanctification, a wonderful conference. It's on our website. He has 4 or 5 lessons, I think, on sanctification. And the biggest thing I took away from that I remembered, when we think of sanctification, we think of the process of becoming holy and how that works, and rightly so. But the thing he drove the most that I remember was that true sanctification is when someone beloves Christ, when someone delights in being sanctified by knowing Christ. It's not out of duty. True sanctification, he says, will never come out of duty, out of just trying to do righteous things. It comes out of a love for Christ. That will always be present when we are being sanctified. Look here at Matthew chapter 12 with me. Matthew 12, 33 through 37. We'll look at two places that talk about someone that is trying to live in the world, but also trying to obey Christ and follow God. Matthew 12, 33 through 37. Josh preached on this here a while back. Verse 33, Jesus says, "Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give an account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." So we're used to this phrase, "you brood of vipers." What caused Jesus to say that was people trying to live in the world, enjoy all the pleasures of the world, but also outwardly trying to convince people they love Christ. Jesus was never tricked by this. Other people around them might, but Jesus was not ever fooled by this. And this is what caused him to say, "you brood of vipers." He says, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make it bad and its fruit bad. Those people in context, those were bad. Those Pharisees, they were bad. So make your fruit bad as well. Just live in the world. But don't try to be lukewarm. And then Revelation 3 speaks to this being lukewarm. Revelation 3, 15 and 17, another passage that most of us are probably familiar with. Jesus says, "I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So, because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, 'I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing,' not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked." Another seemingly harsh statement from Christ, and I don't mean harsh like bad, I mean something of weight, because he is infuriated with these people that are trying to love the world, not loving Christ, and yet try to make people or convince people or convince themselves that they love Christ. This angers God because he desires that you love him, that you truly want to be one of his followers, and in that be sanctified. Not just do things for him. God doesn't need us to do things for him. He is plenty fine how he is, I promise. He wants your heart. He wants you to truly desire and to love him. It's not duty, it's delight. A Christian doesn't wake up and say, "Ugh, I have to obey Christ's commands again today," or I have to follow Christ, or I have to be willing to give up all my things in light of my love for Christ. A true Christian doesn't say this. A true Christian says, "Please take all that I have. I am willing to give it all because I want nothing but Christ. I want nothing but to know him." Some of you are probably picking up on this duty and delight language. Some of you have read the book, The Dangerous Duty of Delight. It's by John Piper. It's a little red book. I know the ladies have read it. I highly recommend it. The Dangerous Duty of Delight. It's a small book from his original book, Desiring God. And it speaks much to this desiring God, delighting in God, and it not just being a duty. So if you wonder how these men of old were faithful to God, such as Moses and Paul, it's because they loved him. Not because they just had a massive amount of self-control, which I'm sure they did. But they were successful because they truly loved God. Verse 26 that we were reading earlier, Moses here considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking to the reward. He didn't want the reward of just all the treasures of Egypt. He wanted the reward of knowing God and being faithful to God. That's why it was easy for him, to some extent, to give up all those things. I love what the Believer's Bible Commentary says on this. This is talking about Moses. So the result of Moses giving up all the treasures of Egypt to follow after God, the result is this. Instead of occupying a line or two of hieroglyphics on some obscure tomb, he is memorialized in God's eternal book. Instead of being found in a museum as an Egyptian mummy, he is famous as a man of God that we hear much of, that made it into Scripture. Think about that. All of the things, the pleasures, and the things that he could have attained there in Egypt would have got him what? Maybe being written on the side of a tomb. He might have got his name there. Or he might have a mummy casket thing somewhere in a pyramid that no one knows about and no one cares about. But he would have enjoyed all the earthly things at that time. That's all he would have gotten. And now I guarantee you he is attaining and receiving a far, far greater reward because he was willing to put those things aside, those things that shine so brightly in our eyes on this earth. Massive amount of money that he would have attained, wealth that none of us probably will ever see. He didn't care about because he understood the reward. He was playing the long game, not the short game. Instead of winning a few short years of earthly fame, he invested and his inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, as 1 Peter 1 talks about. Well, let's move on to verse 3 of this song. It says, "See from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown?" I don't have much on this verse. It's pretty self-explanatory, but this idea or this analogous language of seeing from his head, hands, and feet, sorrow and love flowing mingled down, what do you guys think that's referring to, that word picture? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, the blood, the sweat, the water flowing mingled down. This is a word picture probably from Matthew 27:29 or John 19:2. This speaks of the crown of thorns they placed on him on his head. And then in Psalm 22:16, the prophecy that says, "For dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me, and they have pierced my hands and feet." So this prophecy that was fulfilled and became true speaks to this being pierced, blood flowing, the passage talking about being speared in the side. So blood and water came out of that, right? Flowing mingled down as sorrow and love did. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet? As they flowed mingled down together, they met. Or thorns composed so rich a crown? We talked about this a while back. I think it was the first song we did, "All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name." Speaking of the crown on Jesus' head, and the amount of times that Scripture speaks to it in different forms, sometimes this crown that they placed on his head, they were mocking him, thinking, "Oh, hail King of the Jews, let's put a crown on his head because he claims to be a king." But how Revelation speaks of this being very true, fulfilling prophecy, because he is the Messiah, he is the King, that which most of them at the time didn't know. But he will, in one sense, figuratively, he will wear a crown one day, and he will return with that. And then verse 4 says, "Were the whole realm of nature mine,
that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. This word amazing has been very overused and abused in our life, I would imagine, at least in mine it has. This is one of those words that it still does, obviously, but it meant something of much gravity when it first became a word. Now it's just kind of something we throw out all the time, speaking of like food that we enjoy. Cheyenne's not here, but him and I talk much about how amazing the taco truck is, and it is very, very amazing. But that is not a proper use of the word, because comparing tacos that Phoebean makes to the love of Christ, there is no comparison. So I need to work on using this word better. But we often throw this word around. That was amazing. This food's amazing. Or that play in baseball was amazing. But when Watts used it here, Isaac Watts, it was a brand new word, meaning astounding, astonishing, wonderful, or great beyond expectation. This is the love that he's speaking about. Love so astonishing, or love so wonderful, or love so great beyond expectation. So divine that demands my soul, my life, and my all. The point here is all of nature, as beautiful as it is, as grand as it is, it can't compare to the greatness of God's love. And on top of that, if we could offer all of creation somehow, which we cannot, it's ironic and it doesn't make sense because it's already God's. So not only is all of creation, which again is beautiful, it cannot compare to God's love. If we offered all of it, it's not an appropriate gift. It's not an honorable gift, because it's not equal to the love of Christ, the amazing love of him. So because of this, we have to offer ourselves. So in turn, you have to offer your own body. This is what Matthew 16, 24 speaks to. This is what Luke 14, 26 speaks to. We looked at Luke 14, 26 in detail here a few weeks ago on the song, Take My Life and Let It Be. Those are the two passages that talk about taking up your cross, denying yourself, and following Christ. Or he says, follow me. Because apart from that, we don't have anything to offer back to God because it's already his. We can't take our finances and offer it up to God in one sense, because we need to understand we're just stewards of it. He is the owner of it. Now, do offer our things and finances to God. I'm not saying that. But as some sort of valuable gift that he needs from us. Or as this verse says, all of creation, that's already his. We can't offer it. We might own a piece of land, but it's God's already. This is why we have to offer our own self, our own body. We have to deny ourselves, pick up our cross, put aside all things that we have, reputation, gifts, finances, put those things aside and serve Christ with our own self, with our own person, our body, our whole life, because this is all we have to offer. Romans 12, 1 and 2. You can turn there if you would like. Romans 12, 1 and 2 speaks to this. Romans 12, 1 and 2, it says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. A serious and devout consideration of the mercies of God leads to only one conclusion, and that is we must present our bodies, our whole life, as living sacrifices to God. I love ESV's footnote. Look at verse 1, if you have ESV. The last line, it says, which is your spiritual worship? What does y'all's footnote say there on spiritual worship? Your rational service. I remember we talked about a lot about rationality in that Road Trip to Truth series before this quarter. Rational means logical. And so this is saying it's your logical service. When you assess the value of the cross and think of yourself, it's simply just logic that you would offer your whole body unto God. I love how plain and simple Romans 12 makes it. This is your rational service. This is the thing you should do if you just think even logically, even practically about it. If you will, dumbs it down this much or simplifies it this much. Because again, that's all we have to offer. And not only that, if we're understanding that we must delight in God, that we don't obey his commandments out of duty, but because we love to and we want to, this is the logic that we come to. We're going to offer our whole self unto him for our whole life. We're not going to save back a little compartment or a little part for us. Like, well, we'll do the things we want to do here. But the rest of the time, I'll serve the Lord. No, it's all or nothing. Jesus spoke to that being all or nothing much. Revelation 3 and in Matthew, calling them a brood of vipers because they wanted to save back a little bit for themselves. This is not what God wants. He wants our love and our delight. And I don't have time to speak of it today, but again, in that book, The Dangerous Duty of Delight, it speaks much to and clarifies the fact that it's not this war that you're waging within yourself all of your Christian life to serve God. Now, it is a war that we're waging on our sinful nature, but we're not just in this battle of not wanting to serve God, but then trying to serve him. Again, sanctification is not only the process of becoming more holy, but in the process of becoming more holy, you become, your love for God grows. And so you would love to do this more and more. Again, it becomes more and more easy to put away the things of the world and to follow after Christ because that's what you want to do. If we follow the things of the world, if we serve the kings and pleasures of this world and ourself by trying to attain them because we love them, that's not hard to do. You wake up every morning wanting to do that, thinking about whatever that is, going and spending your time trying to accomplish that. Why? Because you love it. Well, the goal here isn't to keep doing that and just to know it's the best thing to glorify God and to try to follow him, so you got to work hard at it. The goal here is changing your whole heart, and I know we can't change our own heart. But changing your mind to loving this path, waking up in the morning wanting to serve and follow after God, and that being what's on your mind constantly, that being what you love to do, thus being easier to put away all these other things of the world. This is the idea here, and especially the idea in that book by John Piper. We've all heard phrases like this: if the Son of God died for you, then at least the least you can do is live for him. And again, I don't agree with that on one hand, and I don't think that's a good thing to try to put into a sermon to like guilt trip Christians to serve God, right? If the Son of God died for you, then at least you can do is live for him. It also makes it sound like you need to offer the least you have, and that's not the point either. But on a personal level, we should absolutely be thinking, at least this way: if the Son of God gave his life for me, I must give every part of my life and being all for him. Or when I consider the mercies of God, how could I do anything but live for his purposes? We should absolutely be thinking this way, not in the sense that we now owe him something because he did something for us. No, we need to love him and delight in him just because of his very person. Remember, Paul said earlier, he was willing to sacrifice all that he had just for knowing Christ. Not even getting into all the things Christ has done for him, just knowing him. This should be us as well. We're not owing Christ something because he did something for us. But thinking of the thing he did for us and who he is, that should absolutely drive us to give all that we have for the sake of him. And again, I said this last week, when we talk about giving all that we have or sacrificing all that we have, we're not saying, like, go sell it all today and go live on the street. That may be true for some people. I know it has been in the past. But the idea here is your care for those things are little, and you're going to use those things for the sake of God. You might have billions of dollars. We're not saying go get rid of it so you don't have it anymore. We're saying use it for extending and for the sake of Christ and his purposes. Notice here in verse four of this song here, what demands you giving up everything that you have? Well, again, duty doesn't demand your spiritual service. Delight demands it. Look at verse 4. It says, love so amazing, so divine, does what? It demands my soul, my life, my all. Again, we can't sing this song later saying, love so amazing, so divine, it demands that I obey God even when I don't want to. Do we need to do that? Yes. But that's not the point of the song, and that's not the point of many passages we've looked at today. It's love so amazing, so divine, that it demands my soul, my life, my all that I have. This is what demands it. Any thoughts or questions on that duty and delight idea? Maybe thoughts from some of you that have read that book or anything on this topic? I'm sure many of you have heard this analogy, probably even here, but on this idea of duty and delight, you've heard it on human relationships. So if a husband brings a wife flowers, he shows up to the front door, she opens the door, and she's happy to see him, and she says, oh, thank you, and he says, yeah, you're welcome, but I just did this because I knew I was supposed to. Like, I knew this is the right thing to do. Maybe it's Valentine's Day or her birthday or something, so that's why I got you flowers. Oh, well, all of her excitement just lessened very rapidly, because she knows that he's not delighting in her, he's just doing something out of duty. We know this is true and humorous, but in our practical life, oftentimes we don't apply this correctly to God, and we just think, I know that's the right thing to do to have a lot of self-control today, so I'm going to try to deny myself and follow God. Well, it's like, do we think God is sitting up there saying, oh, wonderful, that's exactly what I want? Well, no. He does want our service, absolutely. That's necessary. But we must love him, just like the human level relationships. We don't want someone just to do something for us out of duty that is not meaningful to us. Any comments or questions on this?